Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, President Svoboda, my friends. It is an honor and also a pleasure to be here. I left an ice storm at home. And it's not often that one can say that you flew from Texas to Brussels for the sunshine. I tell my students that the study of economic inequality has two dimensions. One is the distribution function for pay or income or wealth, measured by Lorenz curves and Gini coefficients or tile statistics or ratios between percentiles. In simple language, the extent of the gap between the haves and the have-nots. The other dimension is categorical. It's categorical inequality. Those schemes and traits and attributes that we allow to define and divide us: gender and race, religion and nationality, membership and exclusion. When my students ask which of these is the more important, the more pernicious, I say you have to deal with both. The distribution function describes society as a whole, whether it is compact and egalitarian or sprawling and polarized. Categories predict where on the distribution one will be found. To borrow the language of a notable European political document of some time back, who is the bourgeois, who is the proletarian, who is the master, who is the serf? Let me make just three points that have been, I think, that bear particularly on the relationship between inequality and progressive economic policy in the context of Europe. First is that the creation of the European Union, and perhaps especially of the Eurozone, necessarily and unavoidably increased the relevant construct of the income gap. It did this by converting what had been, in many cases, compact and egalitarian societies into components of something much bigger, a sprawling and much less egalitarian whole. Economic reality changed. Social psychology began to change. Economic statistics did not change, and political institutions did not adjust. Second point is that the overall movement of inequality through time, on the continental scale and also on the global scale, and this is the central finding of research that I have been conducting for several decades now with my graduate students at the University of Texas. This movement of inequality through time is a macroeconomic phenomenon. It's not something which has a great many entirely separated elementary components. It's something that happens to the world or to a continental region as a whole. It is driven by economic performance and policy to a very great extent. And in the neoliberal era, and particularly in the 20 years from 1980 to 2000, this movement was dominated at the high end by the rise of finance, by financialization, and concentration of incomes in the hands of the financial sector, and at the low end by the erosion of the position of low-income workers. the erosion of the real value of minimum wages, the decline of unions, and an ongoing concerted attack on social insurance and the welfare state. That's the neoliberal era in a nutshell, and it happened all around the world. Third, increasing inequality, as measured by a distribution function, has a way of hardening categorical lines and barriers, and even of fostering the creation of new ones. In the United States, the historical dividing line has always been race. In the 50 years since the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, those lines, the black-white lines, have blurred a little, in fact, substantially, compared to where we were a half century ago. But given the rise in inequality overall, new categorical distinctions have emerged and continue to emerge. In particular, the distinction between citizen, non-citizen, between legal and illegal resident. That is a very hard categorical barrier with vast implications for the social structure of my country at the present time. In Europe, let me venture, the joint consequence of economic union and distributive divergence, it has been to reform and to harden categorical lines, including those based on race and religion, but especially those based on nationality. With national hierarchy coming to depend on primarily, and perhaps even exclusively, on national financial position. So one has the creditors and the debtors, and there is no doubt as to which is in the superior and which the lesser position. And the creditors stress and disparage the debtors, while elements in the debtor communities stress and disparage their immigrants. A strict hierarchy and a threat to civilization. Wealth, this is my favorite sentence in the entire canon of economic thought, is the following one. It's very short. Wealth, as Mr. Hobbes says, is power. Adam Smith wrote that. It's in The Wealth of Nations. And the reference to Thomas Hobbes is not incidental. Needless to say, no national community, no confederation of nations, can be run for very long on the commercial principles of a debt collection agency. The entire purpose of republican government is to curb the excesses of feudal lords. That's why we got republican government. That's why it was invented in the first place. And to extend a decent measure of solidarity to all who belong. The only alternative, at least so far as I know in history, is strife and dissolution of the political system. Is there a successful example of handling this problem? Well, I think, quite apart from every European country that built social democracy in the 20th century, I'm not a national chauvinist by any means, but I do think the experience of the United States in the middle of the 20th century is a reasonably good, or has some reasonably good features worth thinking about. Because what we did in those years, from the 1930s through the 1960s, was to stitch together a country that had never recovered from the Civil War and that had never overcome the racial barriers instigated by slavery. And going on from reconstruction, massive public investment and development, to Social Security and labor rights, to civil rights and voting rights and immigration reform in the 1960s, and then health care. This was an America which was described at the time as being a country of countervailing power. And I think it does present some elements that are worth thinking about. The restructuring of debts as a proper function of the public system, public investment as a responsibility, the control and reform of a failed financial sector, and social solidarity. And these are the elements which Yanis Varoufakis, Stuart Holland, and I have drawn on in part in our modest proposal to resolve the crisis of the Eurozone. This is the Édition Française, Modeste Proposition pour résoudre la crise de la zone euro, avec une préface très aimable de Michel Rocard. It's a small book. You can read it quite quickly. Let me suggest, therefore, that the challenge of the Eurozone and the challenge of inequality are the same challenge. They cannot be separated. The means of dealing with one are the means of settling the other. I would close by warning a little against placing an overly symbolic, overly abstract cast on these questions. What is needed are concrete and practical steps. You need to control the rapacious growth of income at the top, which has been carried out by the means of concentration of power in the financial sector. And one needs to extend the systems of insurance and social solidarity, employment, and minimum wages, so that the entire population of the whole community that one is concerned with is protected from the kinds of stresses that economic instability can place upon it. But symbols are not entirely without relevance. I think it did make a difference to the psychology of American society that we elected and re-elected a son of Africa as president of the United States. And while I would not wish to take sides in any European political question, it does occur to me that if something similar were to happen here, if, for example, a young leader of one of the crisis countries of suitably progressive views, possibly, for example, a Greek, were to be elected to a significant office in the European Union, that would have rather remarkable psychological effects. Thank you very much for your attention on these matters.
Thanks to you, Professor Galbraith, you took us